Greetings from West Virginia. My name is Jan and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 14, 1964, and my home group is the Coal River Group at St. Albans, West Virginia. Before anything else, I want to say that this is a great honor for me being here. From the time that Bob called and asked me to talk, to the minute I got here and was greeted by Ralph and Gary and Janet come forth to welcome me, and Bill came down to tell me about a workshop. Everybody I have met has treated me with exceedingly good hospitality. I've been touched by it. And I must say that from the onstart, I felt we were all kindred spirits. I'd like to introduce my husband who is with me. Bob, would you stand? Bob likes to tell people that we have been happily married 38 years. And then he adds, not bad out of 50. And it's the truth. We celebrated 50 years just this past May. Okay, so let's get down to what it was like. It was awful. It was just awful. My first taste of alcohol was in the form of wooden shoe beer. It was at a family picnic when I was just a kid, and the keg of beer was put on a bench under at the end of a picnic table, and my brother crawled beneath the table, and I think the fascination was with the little spigot he turned. And he would get cups of beer, and our parents and all didn't realize what was going on. From my very first encounter with alcohol, my brother and I and all of our cousins were forbidden to go into this pasture that was very close to the picnic area. They said, don't go over there. There are livestock over there. The first thing we did was we headed for the pasture. There was a little bull they called Dummy, and I remember my brother and I taking turns trying to boost one another up onto the back of this little bull. That might seem insignificant, and yet, my first encounter with alcohol, and what did I do? I put my life in danger. See, I can look back, and I see there were mile markers. I started dating college boys when I was about 19, and they got me introduced to slow jam. I dated these guys, and there was a group of them that belonged to the Kappa Alpha fraternity. And I thought that I was pretty sharp dating these college guys. Not even one member of my family had graduated from college. And they had this song they used to sing, and we girls would join in with them, and it went, at the bar where the Kappa Alpha are, and the pride of the chapter staggers then dead drunk and we'd stomp our feet. Well, to hell with all the rest, cause we know we are the best. Drink 'em down, Kappa Alpha, drink 'em down. And I obliged them. I had my first blackout when I was 19. I didn't have any idea what a blackout was until after I got to AA. I thought what was forgetting, I was forgetting, I learned was a blackout. What I thought was falling asleep was a pass out. And I started doing those early in my drinking. And I was told about something that I did at an office party when I was 19. It wasn't anything bad. It was that I was just going on and on about not wanting to take the stationery inventory. But I had no recollection of it. And when the girls told me about it the next day, I was very surprised. I had a rather strict upbringing. I was one of six children born into an Irish Catholic family. I had good parents, and I was taught high morals. And I was a shy kid. I was always shy, and kind of hung back. I felt good when I was with my brothers and sisters, but I was not a very good mixer. And I think for that reason, alcohol was a natural for me. Now, I met Bob in Cincinnati. He was from Philadelphia. We met in Cincinnati, and we became engaged, and he came to West Virginia after he got out of Korea, back from Korea, and we got married. And it didn't seem like alcohol was a major part of our life, but we started going to these house parties that were friends of my brother's in St. Albans. And the idea was that everybody brought their own bottle. And it would be a Saturday night party, and then it seemed that we would start drinking maybe like on Wednesday and Saturday and Monday, Wednesday and Saturday. And it became almost a daily thing in a very short length of time. I think along the way, for many of us and certainly for me, there are warning signs. When we had only been married less than 2 years, we awoke one morning, and fortunately we had just bought a window fan, but the apartment, our bed was on, a chair was on fire, and the house was filled with smoke. And we hustled the chair out onto the back porch, poured water on it, and it smoldered. But that was a sign that it was a cigarette left in an ashtray on the arm of the chair. We endangered ourselves and our little boy that time that was still sleeping in a baby bed. I never connected it with alcohol. Never thought about that. As we continued drinking, we bought a little house and we moved up on this hill and we made friends with a couple up the street. And I had a few cronies that I drank with them in the afternoon. But it seemed that my drinking became out of control rather quickly. We started arguing more. He had a nice job managing a department at one of the big stores. And I was a secretary I worked for the railroad and I made good money. But it seemed like we never had money. We were always late on our bills, and there were times that we became so broke that we would search the cushions of the couch looking for money. And I remember once we even lifted the grate off of the floor furnace, thinking there might be some coins down there. Cashing in large groups of pop bottles. We used to let them line up on the back porch and down the steps. When we got enough, we'd take them and cash them in. That is not normal. And I think a lot of it was because of being under the influence of the drinking, our judgment was shaken. We wouldn't pay our bills. We didn't shop wisely. We paid high interest when we shouldn't have. And we let ourselves get into a bad way. And because of this cramped lifestyle, we started arguing with each other more. Things became less peaceful on the home front. I knew that there was something wrong with me. I knew from the nervousness and the anxiety I would feel of an afternoon that I would have to drink beer to calm down. And then I would drink beer with my cronies, and when he would come in from work of an evening, I'd switch over and drink bourbon with him. And I felt very guilty about this because I knew what I was doing wasn't right. I knew the way our bills were mounting up and things weren't getting done around the house. The arguing was increasing. And I went to my doctor and I talked to him about it. This doctor said to me, between being Irish and working for the railroad, it's only natural to drink. He said this to me. He prescribed Librium for me, and he sent me home with my little vial of green and blacks. And I went home, and I started taking them. But I didn't want to spend my money on pills. I would rather have, if I was going to buy something to make me feel better, I preferred the alcohol, the bourbon. The guilt set in. I remember a phase when I was feeling guilty about how our life was going. And I remember promising my little boy that at 3 o'clock in the afternoon after he got home from school, there was a Tarzan series that was showing then. And I said, "Now you come in." And I says, "I'll fix popcorn and we'll watch Tarzan together." It's such a simple thing, but I couldn't even keep my word on that. I'd end up drinking beer with Mary Lou and Betty up the street, and by the time he came home from school, there was no popcorn, and after a couple Tarzan series, I let go of it. And I knew intuitively in my heart this was not right. My mother didn't raise us kids like that. She was there for us all the time. This nervousness came over me, and I got concerned about myself because everything that we had tried had not worked to quit drinking. I went to my priest, and I talked to him about my drinking and Bob's drinking. And I remember he told me that there was a group of people in St. Albans. He says they're members of AA, and they have a meeting right here in town. And he says, "I think you should go to those meetings." But I wouldn't listen to him. I said, "No." I says, "I want to take a pledge." And I knelt down on my knees in his office beside his desk. And I asked Father to give me a blessing. And I said, "I will swear before God I'll never drink again." Within 6 weeks, I was drinking again. Things got worse around the house. The fears got worse. One night coming home from a New Year's Eve party, I took a swing at Bob with my evening purse for some reason. And he was driving crooked, and the next thing I know, the red lights were flashing behind us, and the police took us to jail. And they took his belt and his shoelaces, and they were going to lock him up. And I says, "Well, you can't do that to him." And they locked me up, too. And I'll tell you, there's times when shame can just, I think, fall over us like a dark blanket, and it did that next morning when I woke up in that jail. We had had to call our drinking friends, Mary Lou and Walter, to tell them to keep the kids overnight. We wouldn't be coming home. And I remember sitting on that, it was like a metal cot, looking down at that old dirty cement floor, and I kept thinking, what would my mother say if she could see me now? You know, that still quiet voice within us, put there by God, that conscience, does not sleep. We may deafen our ears to it, but it does speak to us, and it spoke to me that morning. And I felt so ashamed. But our out was that Walter brought the deed to his house and bailed us out, and we resumed drinking again. I had this fear that if I didn't get help, I was going to go mad. And I went back to my priest and I told him that I was plagued with fear and nervousness. I couldn't go to a PTA meeting without drinking first. I wanted no social contacts with anybody. We had even stopped going to our neighborhood parties. It just boiled down to this one other couple up the street. So he recommended that I go to a psychiatrist. And Bob used to drive me up there, and it was some distance. It was in Wheeling, West Virginia. And I would lie on this couch, and he would sit in his chair behind me and take notes. And I would rattle off things. And I think possibly the doctor himself was trying to help me, but I was probably incapable of even recognizing the truth about my life. But he warned me up front. He says, "Now, I'm going to give you an antidepressant." And he says, "If you ever drink, don't come back here." He says, "You cannot mix alcohol with any medication I give you." Well, that sobriety, or that being dry, lasted about 3 months. And eventually, Bob bought a bottle, and I found out about it and threw a fit. And I decided, well, if he was going to drink, I was going to drink too, because I get even with him for buying the bottle. And I picked right up to where I'd left off, And it was with a recklessness, reckless abandon. I just didn't care. I blamed him for my drinking. If he hadn't bought that bottle, I would have been okay. We had opened a little pet shop, tropical fish and small animals. We ended up drinking up the profits and having to sell that little business to the woman that worked for us. Another night we woke up, or early one morning, and there were firemen in the house because our mattress had caught fire. The firemen took our two children and carried them out. They carried Bob out and put him on the couch, and they helped me out of bed. And I'll never forget that day. My mother used to use a word, trashy. And she'd say, "Those people are trashy. Don't go over there." My mom had very high morals, and she taught me to always be a good girl. And she'd say, "Don't do that. That's trashy." Well, I'll tell you, when I was standing in my doorway and the neighbors were gathered out in front of the house, and our mattress, smoldering mattress, was slung out in the front yard, I felt trashy. And yet I tried to make a joke about it and wave to my two beer-drinking friends. And there wasn't anything funny about it. I used to pray to God that if he would give me a second chance, that I would never drink again. And what I wanted more than anything was a new baby. I said, "If you would give me another baby, I would devote my life to this little one, and I won't drink." And I did become pregnant. But it was not a good pregnancy, and the doctor told me, he says, "I don't think that you can go full term," because I was having difficulty. Well, one night at home, it was a Saturday night, and there was a Miss America pageant was on the television. I was on the couch, and I had not been drinking that night. But Bob was. He had been drunk, and he was passed out in the other room. And I started to lose the baby there at the house, and I called my friend Mary Lou, and she came down, and Bob raced me up to the hospital not far from our home. And that night, you know, I've heard it said that sometimes miracles come wrapped in pain, and certainly ours did, because I felt like that was my last hope. And he took me up to the hospital, and I was sober, and he was drunk. And for the one and only time in my life, I was ashamed of my husband, because he was trying to get me the best room and telling the doctors and nurses what to do, and he was drunk. And I checked into the hospital, and he went home. And something very important happened to me that night, a turning point in my life. I woke up in the wee hours of the morning, and I remember being in this dark room. It was cold and dark in there. And I woke up, and the realization hit me that I had lost the baby. And an old thought came to me. When I was a youngster, it was probably the sisters told me this, but they said when God creates a new soul, he attaches a golden thread to that little soul, an invisible thread that no one can see, but God can, and he never loses contact. And that night, as I was lying there, I felt like a giant pair of scissors had come through, and clipped that thread, and I'd been cut off from God. I can't ever remember a minute in my life that I was angry enough to God or didn't believe in God, but that night I was very close to despair. Bob came to see me the next day, and we got in an argument, and he went back to the house. Then the next morning I was to be released. And when he came back up that next morning, I learned that he had been arrested after he dropped me off that night. He had been arrested by the police, and they had taken our car, and they had taken him to jail. And so he had to send Mary Lou up to get me out of the hospital. And on the way home from the hospital, I had my last drink. It was a beer. I went back to Mary Lou's house, and Bob was waiting for me, and we had this old junker car, and he was driving up the hill toward our house. And the car started chugging, and the red light on the dashboard was flashing, and he hadn't put oil in the car, and the car just wouldn't make it up the hill. And I had to get out of the car and walk up the hill. And I said, only another woman knows what deep, deep shame feels like when another woman is pointing at her. And that's the way I felt, that every woman on that street was looking out their window, pointing at me and saying, there she goes, there goes the drunk. And I felt terrible. And I went back into that old dirty house. The house was unkept. There was no carpet on the floor. Bob came in a little while later. He had a bottle under his arm, and the car never made it up the hill. He had left the car at the foot of the hill. Bob had never mentioned AA before, but that evening he called out to me, and he says, call AA. So I called my priest, who got in touch with a fella who went to that Coal River meeting. And a fella named Al Kelly, who's deceased now, he called, and he talked to me about Bob, and he says, now, if your husband wants help, he says, I will be down there in the morning to see him. So the next morning, I woke Bob up, and I said, were you serious about AA last night when you told me to call? And he said, yes, I was serious. And I said, there's a man coming to see you. There was one drink left in our bottle, and Bob drank it that morning, and that was his last drink. And this fella named Al came to see us. He was an old-timer. But, you know, I knew the minute that he walked in our door, and this is very significant, too. When you think that there's two helpless, hopeless alcoholics whose lives were going down the drain, and a fella from AA comes and knocks on our door, and we never drank again. We haven't drank since then. That's quite remarkable, isn't it? And that's the power of the 12-step call. Al told us about hitchhiking to Akron, Ohio to get sober. Hitchhiked all the way to Akron. And I didn't know who he was talking about, how significant it was, that he said the first man he met was Dr. Bob Smith. And Dr. Bob said, he said he was a big raw bone man. That's the way he described him. And he says, Dr. Bob told him, I'm not going to drink today, and if you stick with me, maybe you won't either. And he lived with Dr. Bob for a while. Al told us that in AA, the men work with the men and the women work with the women. And he says, I'm going to take your husband to a meeting. And he says, I'm going to put you in touch with a woman, and her name was Christine. Christine, I didn't know at the time that had only been sober 2 or 3 months. But she won me over with her kindness and introduced me to people, and we started going to meetings together. And I really believe that by the time I walked through the doors of AA, I had already embraced the first 3 steps. Certainly, I was powerless over alcohol. There was no doubt about that. And certainly, my life was unmanageable. I remember one day being angry because Bob wouldn't take this old washer motor out of the basement. And I remember, as it was just a thought that flashed through my mind, I was driving along this road, and there was the thought, why don't I just turn the wheel and take this car right over this hill? But my little boys were in the back seat, and I wouldn't do it. Insanity? I knew about insanity. I know about going in the bathroom once with a butcher knife and Bob having to break the door to get into me because I was threatening to do something bad. I've looked back and I thought, I can't imagine myself taking my life. It's against everything I believe in. But I did used to go and stand beside his gun cabinet, and I used to imagine if I could put a bullet right through here on the side of my head, and I would imagine a doctor opening up my head and looking in and saying, this is what's wrong with her, but we'll fix it. And he had to hide the guns. I come to know that in chapter 5 they speak of the narrow path. I see it as a very narrow path and the path less chosen. And that's where they put my feet, was on the narrow path. And the people told me that there were steps that I would have to follow. And I embraced wholeheartedly that third step. I think I'd embraced that step before. I think before we even called AA, I was that ready. And I've come to know that this path winds upward. It gets steep at times, but there are plateaus or resting places where I was allowed to look back over my past and see that there was progress being made in my life. Bob and I started attending meetings on a regular basis, and our little boys were happy about that. Our first Christmas in AA, nobody in Charleston would give us credit. The utility companies would not take anything but cash, and our water had been cut off just before we come into the program. And yet our first Christmas in AA, I bought Bob a dollar gift, he bought me a dollar gift, and an AA member who was rather new in the program stopped by my house with a Christmas card, and inside was a note and $15, and it said, "This is what I plan to tithe at my church this Sunday, and I want you to have it." And we bought our kids $15 worth of toys. Things started off good for us in AA. We loved the meetings, and we knew within short order that something special was happening in our lives. For us to go just a matter of 2 or 3 days without drinking was remarkable. And we started chalking up the weeks and the months. And we got busy in AA service. Started chairing meetings the first few years. You know, became intergroup reps, intergroup secretary, GSRs, sponsoring people. But this is something, and especially to the new people, that I would like to emphasize. I failed to take the fourth and fifth steps when I should have. Granted, the steps were not talked about a lot when I first came into the program, other than we had to take them. And we would take them, like Bob would say, "I had a chance to take such and such step today." Or I'd say, "Well, I took the 10th step today." We took them randomly, like buckshot. Not realizing that each step was like a link that connected to the next step, and that there was a progression to the sobriety. I would tell my friend Mary Lou, she came in 7 months afterwards, and, you know, I would reveal things to her. And I thought, well, I took the fifth step. You know, I mentioned this to Mary Lou, and Bob knew a lot of what I'd done, and I let it coast on that. Well, let me tell you what happened. The main compulsion, alcohol, was put down, but one by one, other compulsions sprung up. It had to happen. I started taking an interest in other things and all into excess. I never felt like the other girls growing up. I never felt accomplished. But this time, I had these compulsions to start learning things. And I took some college classes. I started taking a cake decorating class. I took decoupage. Raising tropical fish. Tropical fish. I went out one day and found they were at a yard sale, but I bought 8 15-gallon tanks. We had tropical fish all over the house. I took an interest in antiques, and the dangerous part was I would go to these auctions, and I started going on a regular basis, and I was going with the girl that I was sponsoring. And she and her husband would go. Well, they had a big, nice, big house, and they had room for a lot of antiques. Our house was small, and I not only had room, but I didn't have the money either. And I even started using a credit card. But there was something exciting about raising my paddle, number 50, and bidding. And I would buy these things, and then I would have to sell them again. But and I'll tell you something funny, and it's when I think God winked at me. I was going down the street one day. I was trying to taper off from auctions on the yard sales. And I was driving down this street, and I saw this sign, and I thought it said, you know, garage sale or yard sale. And I did a U-turn and came back, and it said night crawlers, 50 cents a dozen. I became sick with this. I saw a cartoon once that was, it showed this little car going down the road, and there was this man behind the wheel, and the car was just loaded down with antiques. And there's a woman hanging out the window. They pass a golf course, and you hear a voice say, four, and she hangs out the window saying, 450. But I'll tell you what, my failure to take the fourth and fifth step to clear away the wreckage of my past, I didn't do it. And I heard an old nun once say, that which is not brought up is buried alive. And I had stuff that was packed down layer upon layer. And I had not brought it up. And I had not told it like the book recommended. And I started becoming somehow alienated within myself. And one of my first recognitions was I sat down once to write a card, and I couldn't put enough words together to complete a card. It was a sympathy card or something. My spirit was dying. It was wasting. And yet I was going to meetings. I was staying sober. I had accumulated several years sobriety. I hadn't taken a drop of alcohol, but neither had I taken those vital steps. And the big book tells us we must take these steps or we are in danger of drinking again. One day I fell down on my knees beside my bed and I said, God, please take hold of my life. And I'll tell you, I think God hears every prayer, except His solutions are never quite like what we imagine. I was looking for some type of a flashy, exciting God stand that would just restore my serenity. I don't know what I expected, but it came in a quite different way. I found myself pregnant again. The doctor told me that my child might have Down syndrome. Bob's business that he had started, a microfilming business, the coal mine shut down and he lost a lot of his best customers. His alcoholic father had come to live with us. Bob's business went bankrupt and we were in hard times again. And yet, you know, I think it had to happen to me. I think I had to hit another bottom, because I had drifted into complacency. I had let hobbies, cake decorating, auctions, education, and other things become first place with me instead of my sobriety. I was doing it all right by the book, but not from my heart. I was scared about this little baby. And I was at a retreat one weekend, and I remember I'd gone upstairs, my ankles had swollen up and my legs, and I was just within a few months of delivery, and I was sitting up in the bed crying, and the rest of the group was downstairs, and I could hear them singing this song in the distance, "Be not afraid, I go before you always, come follow me." And I could hear the girl singing that downstairs, and it was like a personal message to me. And I hung in there. And let me tell you, I had a fine little boy. His name is Michael Joseph. And he has 8 years sobriety in this program today. But I I could not live with this fact that I had not taken this fifth step. And I remember praying to God to find somebody that I felt safe to take it with, because I thought my sins were so unique, I didn't want the press to get hold of it. Egotistical. And I remember one day I was at Mass, and there was an old Franciscan priest came in, and it was a sense, there's your man. He was not from our town. He was from a little town outside of Charleston. And I went to him, and I told him what I was about, and he knew what I meant to accomplish. And on my knees, face to face, I took the fifth step with him. And I gave him my list of sins and told him the things that I had done. And he gave me a blessing. And before I parted, he said, young lady, your greatest sin is pride. And I don't know what he perceived from my confession or my fifth step, but that's what he told me that I was suffering from. And he let me to figure it out for myself. I got great relief from that fifth step, and that fifth step shone the spotlight on a lot of my character defects. When I went back and looked at the book has them in columns. Who are you angry with? Who do you resent? What did they do? Why do you resent them? And especially, what was my part in that? I had never looked at that. And some of the things that I was angry about or keeping bottled up inside, a lot of them I had instigated myself, and I never saw it. I was blind to it. And humbly, I asked God to take these things from me. And I started moving on with the steps. When I came to the eighth step, I had a big amend to make to my parents. They had been good to me over the years. And God blessed me with the fact that my dad died the first year that I was sober, and I was standing beside his bed when he died. And I was the last person in our family to be with my mother when she died. And that was an absolute blessing, because they were concerned about my drinking. I had never been able to express my feelings much. The Irish don't do that. There's not any huggy-kissy stuff usually with the old Irish. But I wrote a love note to my mom, and I never told anybody about it. And again, I wrote it in shorthand in case it was discovered. But I made some amends, and I told her how much I loved her, because I never did that before. And I slipped it under her hand in the casket. And I count that as a blessing. Bob and I had an agreement because our sins against one another were of a like kind, and we knew what we had done. And we made a decision that the biggest amend we could make to each other is to never again bring up the past or what we had done to hurt each other. And to this day, and it's been 40 years, neither one of us has pointed the finger at the other and said, well, look what you did back then. The hardest amend I had to make was to our oldest son. And it's funny how God brings things to our attention. I was at a seminar up in Parkersburg, West Virginia, and the presenter was doing a healing prayer. And what she did, she suggested that we pretend that we were just babies again and took us through different stages of our life, that we would try and remember what it was like when we came into the world and if our parents welcomed us or if we were poor or if there were hard times or if we had difficulty going through school, and asked God to heal those memories. And all of a sudden, out of the clear blue, I had this image of myself slapping the face of my little boy when he was 2 years old. Bob and I were neglectful, but we were not abusive to our children. And it was as clear as though I was watching it in a movie, and I remember the precise morning that it happened. And he had been crying all night and hanging on. I was worn out, and I remember slapping his little face. And a little bit later, a yellow trickle come out of his ear, and the little guy had had an ear infection. And I took him to the doctor and found out that's what it was. But when the recollection of that came back to me, I started weeping to where I could not stop, and the tears were pouring down the front of me. And a kind lady came up beside me, and she says, "It's okay." She says, "That's what we're here for." Now, that's the only recollection I have had of such a thing out of the past that tore me up like that. But I did call my son. I told him, I says, "I have to make an amend to you about something that happened when you were just 2 years old." And he didn't want to hear it. And I said, "You have to hear it, because I've got to tell you that I'm sorry and ask your forgiveness." He laughed it off and said, "Mom," he says, "you spoiled us." But it made all the difference in the world to me. I made that amend, and I felt better. And I started to see with new eyes, Dr. Bob's new pair of glasses, I started seeing with new eyes the purpose of these steps. You talk about a design for living. I said, they are a masterpiece, an absolute masterpiece for redirecting our lives and making us whole again. I learned that with the 10th step, the step doesn't say, continue to take a personal inventory and when wrong, admitted it. It said, if you're wrong, it said, when you're wrong. And I've learned that I absolutely cannot let little things pile up inside of me. I cannot live with unfinished business. And I've learned that oftentimes, and I hear it around our tables, when people are angry or they're depressed or they're upset over something or they just don't know what's wrong with them, 9 out of 10 times it's unfinished business. It's something that we were meant to do and we haven't taken care of. And I try today to not let these things pile up on me. I started paying more attention to the 11th step meditation. And some years back, I made the habit of every morning when I get up, I'm in my chair and I put my coffee beside me. And I say, "Good morning, Lord. This is Joni, reporting for duty." I got that from another fella, but I thought, I like that. And then I say that third step prayer, and I follow it with the 7th step prayer. And I'll tell you something I didn't notice for a long time about that 7th step prayer. But that prayer says, "My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. And I ask that you take from me every defect of character that stands between my service to you and to my fellows." Every now and then a new person will come into the program and some wise guy will say, "It doesn't matter what you have for a higher power. It can be a doorknob or it can be a table or a footstool. My Creator is not a footstool." It was not a footstool or a table that rescued two people who were going down the drain. One of the saints, I think it was Thomas Aquinas, described God as an old man standing on top of a bridge like this, dressed in white with long hair and his beard whipping in the wind. And he said, God stands up on the top of this bridge, and he related this image of standing over a river, the river of life. And he says he can look down upon our lives and he can see everywhere we've been. And he can look straight down and he can get an instant glimpse of our life just as it is. And he can see far, far, far ahead into the future where we're headed. And I like that image that God's got a track on me at every millisecond of my life. And I needed God at one particular time in my life. You know, quite often we talk about, and I know we tell a lot of the new people, that they're going to be happy, joyous, and free. But not all the time. Not all the time. There's a lot of happiness and joy and freedom certainly in our lives, and we have a lot of good laughs at our meetings, and that's how we get wells with laughter. But oftentimes, hard things come into our lives that break us. almost break us down. And if we don't have the program and God to hang on to, we can return to that dingy old life again. And such a thing happened to us. I came in from a meeting one night and got a telephone call that our son, Sean, had been arrested. He and some of his little buddies had been out drinking beer, and the police took him to jail. And I went down to get Sean out and brought him home. And after he got home, I could look at him, and I knew there was something that was not right. Now, I'd worked with alcoholics for a long time. I'd done a lot of 12-step work. And I can look into the eyes of alcoholic, and I can talk the language. But there was something different about our son that night. He had ingested something that left him with blank eyes. And I called the police, and I said, there's something wrong with our son, and I want to bring him back down. Bob was taping an Al-Anon conference, and I was there with my 2-year-old and my 80-year-old father-in-law. And I was scared the way he was acting. And in a little bit, he came through the hallway carrying a rifle. He wasn't himself, and he had an odd look in his eyes. In a little bit, he jumped out the bathroom window and ran around the side of the house and into our basement. And I called the police, and I said, please come. My son's got a gun, and I'm scared. And I ran to the neighbor next door. A young man, a friend of the family, had come up, and he got in the car with Mr. Mack, my father-in-law, and I went next door, and I was looking out this woman's off of her deck, and I could see the police cars come up on our street, and I could see those flashing blue lights, and I could see the policemen circling the house with flashlights, and I didn't know what to expect. And just before the policeman came and knocked on the door, I heard a tinkling sound. And when my neighbor answered the door, he asked to see me, and he said, your son is dead. The police said it's possible that he was trying to climb up on top of a chair and out a small window. It's possible that the gun may have gone off and shot him. I never know. But he died that night. When I went to bed that night, I felt like a slab of cement had been laid across my chest or an iron plank, and I felt like I was sinking and being pushed down lower and lower into that bed. And I could go back through his life and imagine everything I should have done and didn't and could have done and wouldn't. And all of the regrets of that little boy's life came flying back into my mind. When I was drinking, before I went to see the psychiatrist, I used to imagine that if I didn't get help, that they were going to get me and put me in an asylum. And I'd be an old lady in a rocking chair in some old gray building with bars on the windows. And that night, that image came back to me. Because I did not think of a drink, but I thought, I can't stand it. I can't live in this house. I can never go back down in that basement again. And I thought I was going to go mad. And it was 3 days before the funeral mass. I think sometimes of life as like crossword puzzles. Ordinarily, well, back in time, different times when I used to say prayers and I wouldn't know how they were going to be answered, and it was that God would move in certain directions and he would move people to do certain things, that one piece of the puzzle would link up with another, and pretty soon enough of the pieces of the puzzle would come together that it presented a picture of hope. And that's what God was doing for us that weekend of Sean's funeral. I remember thinking, I can't make it to that cemetery. I thought, I'll go mad. And during the funeral mass, I just kept thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do. I can't go up to that cemetery. I can't go through that burial. And here, what my sister had done was the most beautiful thing. She had four daughters, and our son Sean used to go to her farm and play with those girls when they were little. And the oldest girl, Mary Margaret, a beautiful young girl, during the quiet part of the Mass, just before the end of the service, she stood up beside Sean's casket with her flute and played Kumbaya. Someone's crying, Lord, come by here. And I tell you, it was like a protective shield came down around me. All the anxiety drained out of me. And when I got to the funeral car and I told Bob about it, he said he felt the same thing. It's something when you think that the creator of this entire universe on that particular moment at that funeral mass took time to look down upon my life and put together what my sister's little girl did. We went to the cemetery, and after the service, the other little cousin, Julie, who the girls played in the school band, she walked up on a little knoll, a little grassy knoll, and she put her school trumpet to her lips and played taps for Sean as a final salute. When I look back at what God did for us that morning, I think it is as though He had dispatched two little angels down to console us and to let us know, somebody said today, God's got your back. And I thought He wanted me to know, I've got you covered. I'm here for you. Well, it wasn't going to bring Sean back. That couldn't be. But He let me know that He was on my watch. The day after Sean died, my friend Mary Lou was diagnosed with terminal cancer. She had put together 12 years of sobriety. And I remember I had just went to pieces that morning. I was thinking, it isn't right. Mary Lou had five kids. Her husband kept drinking. She'd worked two jobs and got sober, and she was a good soul, and she was my best friend. And I thought it didn't seem right that I should lose Sean and then that she was going to die too. And again, it was like a piece of the puzzle was locked in because my telephone rang. And when I picked up the phone, it was a woman from church, and I belonged to a society called the Legion of Mary, where we go and visit people in the church if there's been a death or a problem, and we go to console them. And she asked me to go visit this woman who had lost her husband. And I had a moment of clarity. I thought, I didn't like that woman. I didn't. Not many people did. She had lost her husband. But this woman was mean and contemptible and spiteful and hateful, and she had turned bitter. And in that moment of clarity, I recognized the truth. Either I could thank God for my good friend Mary Lou and thank Him for my wonderful son, who I believed was with Him in heaven now, or I could become like this woman and become mean and embittered and shake my fist at God and just live in a spiteful life. And I realized I couldn't go that route. I've learned, and a lot of it is from the people and many of them who have come after me, that there's going to be some bitter hardships that are going to come our way. I know a guy that broke his back, a girl whose house burned, my best friend today, Pat, who lost her son, a fine ball player, who got sick and threw up in the night and died in another city. And I mean, I've witnessed close up her agony and her pain. And I've seen people lose their jobs or lose their spouses. And I've come to believe that the alcoholics are some of the bravest people I've ever met. Because when we band together, we become very, very strong. And when we witness raw courage within another, that a glimpse of that will come back to rescue us in a time of weakness. And I've got a lot of those people in my home group. On the 12th step, I have tried to carry the message and to practice the principles of AA in my life. And I want to tell you about a particular... How much time do I have? I want to tell you about a particular 12-step call I made. I got a call once that there was a little girl holed up in a hotel uptown. And I couldn't get an AA member, and I got an Al-Anon to go with me. And because it was a flea bag hotel and in a kind of a dangerous territory, I asked a friend of ours to go with me, a man. And I went into that hotel, and if anybody has ever seen the Holly Hotel, they would know what it was like. We walked up these steps, and just at the beginning of coming into the hotel, you could smell the stench. And we walked up into these creaky old floors and knocked on this door, and there was a little girl about 19 sitting on the edge of the bed. It was a little black girl. And she was looking down, and she just had that heartbroken look about her. She was dressed in nothing but a little slick raincoat, a little short raincoat. And I noticed across the tops of her wrists and across the tops of her legs, above her knees, were razor marks where she had been cut. She had cut herself or someone had. And I remember being so afraid, because I'd not been in an atmosphere like that before, I started to panic, and a streak of selfishness ran through me. I started thinking, I can't stand this, and I was afraid, and I was shaky, and I didn't know quite what to say to her. And the fellow who came with us, if somebody wanted to be concerned about their anonymity, it should have been him. He owned a big construction company, and he was well known around town. He was a big guy, a real sharp dresser. And I remember when I was standing, leaning over this little girl, talking to her and being so afraid, he walked up beside me, and what I have captured this image was his leather shoe coming into my line of vision. I could see the tip of his shiny brown leather shoe. And while I was playing the coward, wishing I weren't there, I heard him say to her, "Don't worry, honey, we're going to help you." And we did. We took her down to a treatment center, and they wouldn't accept her. But the thing that happened was he went out ahead of me to get his car, and he had to come around the block and drive his car down the street. So in order for me and this Al-Anon to get her down the street, I had to put my arm around her. And she had on gauntlet boots that come up above her knees and a platinum wig that hung down below her waist. And, I mean, she attracted a lot of attention. With both of us weaving backwards and forwards, because every time she swerved, she would pull one of us with her. And this is the image I got. I worked catty corner from that hotel. I worked in the Courier building. And I could imagine that all these office workers were looking down the street at me. And this is that moment of clarity that came to me after I had made this trip. I remembered that many, many years ago, a very holy man was about to be crucified, and they made him carry his own cross. And they took from the crowd a fellow named Simon to help him out. And what I realized that God had used me as a Simon. Simon had to get close enough to this holy man to see the sweat and to see the trickles of blood come down his cheeks and to see the thorns pressed into his head. And that day I had to get close enough to this little girl that I could smell her fear and I could see her sweat and I could feel her staggering. And every bad glance that was thrown at her bounced off of me, too. And afterwards, and many, many, many times, I have thought back about that 12-step call, and I have thanked God for it. It was a lesson. And on the way down there, we were trying to get her in this place. She was telling me of the terrible things that this man had done to her and made her do. And I remember wishing that she would not talk in those terms. And I realized later, this girl, it was like she was taking a fifth step with me. Not in our way, but she was wanting someone to say, "I don't like this life. I don't like what's happening to me. I need somebody to hear what I'm going through and the things that I've been driven to." And it was very much like this alcoholic. When I asked her if there was anybody from her family who could come and get her, she says, my family's in, it was either North or South Carolina. She says, but Mama's minister might. And she gave me a phone number she got out of her pocketbook. This is after we had taken her to another hotel and the Salvation Army had put her up for the night. And we got in touch with that minister and they did come to get her in Charleston. I do believe that God puts people in our lives that either we have, you know what? The priest told me my greatest sin was pride. Well, that little girl, she taught me what pride was, and I saw it in myself. I'm running short on time here. I want to tell you what it's like today. Life is good. Bob and I just celebrated 50 years of sobriety. We're still very active in AA. We go to lots of meetings, and both of us, we still sponsor people. That oldest boy of ours that graduated with a blank sheet of paper for a diploma, he is now the vice president of sales with a big food company. Our other boy, Michael, graduated from college, and he has 8 years in the program. The blessings come to me in ways that I certainly don't deserve. And oftentimes it's from the new people. They will come in with some hardship or some bright idea or some very simple thing that they will say at a meeting. And I will remember that they were the things told me when I was new or when I just had 90 days strung together. And it will take away whatever that problem of the day was. I no longer have the fear and anxiety that I once had before I come to AA. I have a great sense of comfort sitting down with people who used to just scare me to death. I could visit with, I do believe, I could sit down with President Bush or the governor of our state and not be afraid. There is something of the spirit that when you're just sincere and it's of the truth, something takes over and we are given a great peace. And I feel that today, and it wasn't that way many years ago when I suffered from anxieties and fears. And I believe the reason for this is that because meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting, I am seated with the greatest problem solvers in our world. Now, there are people who can invent great bombs. There are great scientists who can do some high-powered stuff. There's no doubt about it. They can make automobiles that can get you 70 miles to the gallon of gas. But when it comes to human problems and problems of the spirit, or digging up old guilt, or being able to forgive yourself, or find faith in God or in another human being, the best, the cream of the crop, comes right from around the tables of AA. And every day I thank God for that. And I thank you for listening to me tonight. Thank you.